Welcome everybody, we're going to be talking about the return of Iran sanctions and let me go over the agenda first. A couple of things, I'm going to define what sanctions are and then look at typically what causes a failure or success of sanctions. And then give you a very brief history of Iran sanctions. I say brief because Iran has a long history of being sanctioned in the past 40 years. And then we get into reinstatement of the sanctions by Trump, which started early November. We looked at the impact of sanctions and potential Iran's response. Right? Now, what are economic sanctions? Is either the threat or the actual withdrawal of the relationship, commercial relationships between two countries, and typically involves a large country and a smaller country. Okay. Now, I'm going to assume right now that the U.S. is going to be the primary player in the sanctions area. So even though there are other countries that have historically been involved in sanctioning other countries, the primary player over the past 40 years, at least since World War II, has been the U.S. Now, if you look at the definition of sanctions by the Treasury Department, what they designate is a U.S. person. And a U.S. person definition is different than what we customarily think of. U.S. person is anybody who's in the U.S., regardless of whether they are a citizen or not. It also includes all the permanent residents and citizens of the U.S., regardless of where they are in the world, okay? And of course, all the corporations and companies in the U.S. So that designation is very important. What are the key messages of economic sanctions? Essentially, to the sanctioned country that I call a target country, it says, we do not like your behavior in some form or the other. Okay, and we would like you to modify that, right? To allies, it essentially says, we stand behind our words, right? And to the domestic audience, it essentially conveys that you're protecting your interests and values, okay? Now, what are some sanction types? Well, some form of sanction that's very, very common is exports, okay? Which essentially does not allow a country to export their goods and services from another country. Now, when this happens, obviously it causes a lot of hardship. What are some of the hardships? In the case of Iran, for instance, you lose part of your international market, right? Other countries are going to take your place in terms of selling the same goods and services. And of course, you're going to lose foreign exchange, which is critical for buying imports, and a number of other things I get into a little bit later. The other type of sanction is imports, which is less commonly used than exports. And of course, financial. Financial sanctions usually come in three forms. One is if there is a relationship, let's say between the US and Iran, they have loans, outstanding loans, or they provide aids. That's the very first thing that stops when they sanction a country. The second one has to do with financial relationship, okay, banking, critical. And the third one is asset freeze. Now, in the case of Iran, asset freeze has been used multiple times. First time went back to Mossadegh's era in the early 50s. When Iran nationalized oil. And the second time with the hostage taking back in 1979. Okay? Asset freeze is somewhat less common than financial, general financial sanctions. Now, the other two, primary sanctions and secondary sanctions, are important. Because primary refers to relationship, direct relationship between the U.S. and other country, assuming U.S. is a sanctioning country. So if they have sanctions against Iran on exports and banking relationship, essentially all that stops when they impose a sanction. Secondary sanction I'm going to define in a minute because it's very important. And it does expand the periphery of primary sanctions. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later in another slide. So what are the goals of sanctions? One of them is deterrence, to prevent a country from taking certain actions. A good example was the nuclear deal with Iran, or the nuclear sanctions, which essentially told Iran, you cannot pursue nuclear enrichment that ends up being, leads to building of atomic weapons. So that's one form. The other one, asserting leadership, to say that, you know, we are essentially the market leader or leader of a free world, would you say, and we should observe our guidelines. And that has somewhat been used by the U.S. in various periods. The third one is regime change. Now, seldom does a country claim that they impose sanctions because they want to change regimes, but it has been used in the past. In the case of Iran, again, 1950s, Dr. Mossadegh, when he nationalized oil, the primary objective of both the British and the U.S. was to essentially topple them, change his regime, and they eventually did that through a coup. But they have also implemented that or used that tool elsewhere. The fourth type is compensation for nationalized property. Okay? The country nationalizes certain industry that foreigners have invested in, sanctions can be applied in order to recover the original investment. And the last one is to use it for political support. Okay? A lot of times when sanctions are applied, they hardly touch the sanctioned country. A very good example is the case of Tiananmen Square in 1989 against China. Human rights, that sanctions that were applied, essentially was symbolic, did nothing to China. And I'll explain to you why it didn't have any effect in a couple of slides now. All right? So, by the way, since we have a small team here, you can stop me anytime and ask questions. All right, I want to define primary sanctions. Primary sanctions, direct relationship, commercial relationship between two countries. So, when you apply sanctions, essentially that stops. Good example, oil and financial sanctions between Iran and the U.S. Okay? It pretty much stopped everything. Secondary sanction is a little bit different. Secondary sanctions apply to third parties that are not necessarily U.S. citizens. And what U.S. essentially is saying is, if you have commercial relationship with us, and at the same time you pursue commercial relationship with Iran, then we'll sanction you. You know how powerful does this make this whole sanction regime here? The secondary sanctions are very limited. Very limited. Essentially, it tells everybody else, watch out. Don't deal with Iran. If you do that, you jeopardize your relationship with us. And that has really kind of semi-scrambled Iran over the past 7-8 years, especially during 2015, 2016, 2012-2015. It's very powerful. Very powerful. Because essentially it brings third parties into the sanction arena. It's no longer just sanctioning and the sanctioned country. Okay, so what are the success factors? Now, if you have a certain objective in mind that you want to achieve, there are a number of things that could impact whether your objective will be successful or not by sanctioning the country. One is the economic size and the total amount of trade, which is a combination of export and imports. So the size of the country, both the sanctioning and sanction, is relatively important. And typically, sanctions are a lot more effective if they're applied from a big country to a smaller country. Again, typically U.S. and others. That's one factor. Type and combination of sanctions used. Now, in many situations, there's a think tank called Peterson in Massachusetts that has been studying sanctions for the past 40 years. Great amount of detail, okay? And what they have found out is that sanctions are usually helpful when they are used in combination. And economic sanctions typically are more effective if they are combined with diplomatic sanctions, right? So the carrot and stick that I'm referring to is that, you know, you threaten the country, you may apply sanctions, but at the same time, it would be helpful to continue the dialogue. Exactly what happened with JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action of the 2015 agreement that released some of the sanctions on Iran. Because behind the scenes, there was a lot of diplomatic effort between the U.S. Kerry's administration and Iranian government, especially foreign ministry. That's essentially what that refers to. The other factor that's important is whether you have international support or not, okay? If you're acting alone, the chances of success are probably less. The other thing is the duration of sanctions and a couple other factors that are important. The country that's being sanctioned, is it a democracy or an autocracy, okay? If you're a democratic country, you tend to heed the preferences of your populace. So if they're opposed to what you're doing, you're more likely to go along and modify your behavior. But if you're an autocracy, like you're talking about Iran, then obviously they're less attentive to the needs of the population, okay? So that's also important. So essentially the message here is these are success factors. Whether one is successful versus the other depends on the situation, but it's usually a combination that have to be there, has to be there in order for sanction regimes to work. Now, what are some of the failure factors? What are some of the factors that would make sanctions a lot weaker? First of all, if it's a unilateral sanction against the country, as we have the situation now with Iran, with the return of the sanctions just by the U.S., it may spare some public support for their country, for their government. I'm not saying that's happening to a large extent in Iran, because the government is very unpopular. But the average Iranian, I think, perceives that what the U.S. did by not respecting the JCPOA is not fair, especially in light of the fact that UN, European Union, and a lot of other countries have not gone along with Donald Trump. So that's a big factor. To what extent is happening in Iran, I'm not sure, but there is some sympathy here that what they've done to us, or what the U.S. has done with the return of the sanctions is unfair. The other thing is, if you do not have international support, it's unilateral, some of the other countries are going to try to replace you. Okay? In the case of Iran, China is a very good example. China can fill in some of the vacuum that the U.S. has created. Maybe to some of the other countries. There are still a lot of complications, by the way. I don't need to minimize that. But that can happen. The other thing is it may make your allies upset because it affects their relationship with the sanctioned countries. Europeans are losing a lot of contracts because of what Trump did, or potentially his contract. And that has made a lot of them very unhappy. As you read in the press, you know that. And of course, finally, if the combination of sanctions is not that strong, then it may not be effective. So these are some of the factors that contribute to weakening sanctions or maybe rendering it totally useless. Now, this is kind of a very short history of Iran sanctions. As you can see, over the past 40 years, this doesn't include the nationalization era. Just goes back to 1979. there are a series of sanctions that have been applied to Iran under different scenarios or pretexts. Hostage prices, support for Hezbollah, which is essentially is, as far as U.S. is concerned, support for terrorism because they recognize Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Weapons development, ballistic missiles, trade, asset freeze, travel bans, sanctioning IRGC, Revolutionary Guards, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. The only thing, takeaway from this is that when it comes to sanctions, a turning point was 2010-2012. Iran pretty much tolerated all the sanctions that they had been subject to until about 2010-2012. With 2012, since it became unilateral, you have the UN sanctions that for nuclear activity of Iran. You also have the European Union concurring on those sanctions, and what's even more important, Russia and China went along with the UN. It's quite significant. So there was a united front in 2012 against Iran. And as we'll see, that was the only sanction that kind of helped bring Iran to the table. Okay? That's what I have interlude here. Now, I already mentioned that for sanctions to work, you need to have a multitude of factors. And to what extent you are successful, it all depends on the ties and combination of the sanction views. This is a very, very simple, I would call crude model, that takes two of those areas, which tend to be more important when it comes to sanctions, to determine how effective sanctions can be in achieving an objective. On the vertical axis, I show the dependence on imports, okay? So the more you have dependence on imports, especially industrial materials, machinery, and imports that are technology related, you would be going up the axis here. On the horizontal axis, what I'm measuring is the size of trade and the size of exports in particular, including strategic exports. And what do I mean by strategic exports? These are exports that are important to the international market. For instance, if you're an advanced technology country, or if you have a particular product that the world needs, like petroleum and gas. So I break this up into four quarters. In this quarter, we have a country, it applies to countries that have very high dependence on imports, but they're not very big, and the amount of exports they have are not that significant. Okay? So if this country becomes subject of sanctions, they give them usually very poor. Sanctions against them are very effective, because they're so much dependent on things outside their country in order to survive. This quarter, I call it the second one, you have a situation where a country does not rely a whole lot on imports, and at the same time is not a significant exporter. It's not a huge economy. In this case, sanctions cannot be very effective. Typically are not. The third situation is where you are dependent on imports to some extent, but you are such a big country and you have so many strategic exports that sanctions have very little effect on you this quarter. And this one is a question mark. This is for countries that have high dependence on imports and at the same time also are relatively significant in trade size and strategic goods that they sell on the international market. In other words, they are high in both categories. So what would be the examples that we can place in these quadrants?
an example of a country that's very small in terms of GDP and highly dependent on imports, exports fewer agricultural products that everybody else sells to, Liberia in Africa. It can, you know, they essentially cannot tolerate sanctions. They would break down over, you know, a few months. So sanctions is very effective against them. An example of a country that neither depends on imports that much, nor has substantial exports, North Korea. Okay? And that is why North Korea has been there forever, right? They really don't have much to offer, but at the same time, they don't import a whole lot because they're such a poor country. So sanctions are not very effective against them. Example of this quadrant where you have dependence on imports relatively low, but you have substantial exports, you have substantial size, China and India, okay? I use the example of sanctions against China on human rights, 1989, and for India, 1998. Doesn't make a difference, basically symbolic. Here, where the question mark is where things get complicated, all right? Now, Iran fits this category because it's highly dependent on imports, machinery, advanced equipment, laboratory materials, a lot of technological goods. But at the same time, it is relatively good size and has some exports that are strategically important. Maybe not as important as they were 10, 20, 30 years ago, because as you know, we have an oversupply of oil in the market. But Iran is one of the major oil producers and but one of the largest gas reserves too. Okay, so Iran fits in this category. So what can we say about Iran? In order to answer the question whether sanctions have been effective there, we need to look at the types of sanctions, their combination, timing, and how much support they have. That's why here I have 1979 to 2010, a little bit effective. 2012 to 2015, more effective, okay? Now, a simple question here is, if you're a country in this category like Iran, how can you become somewhat immune to sanctions? What are some of the steps you can take? Well, focusing on more industrial goods, producing a lot of those goods internally, domestically, so that you have less dependence on imports, can take you from here to here, right? And that's essentially what Iran has talked about every time they've been sanctioned, and have taken steps, at least in terms of policy, not actual implementation that much, that they want to move in this direction by pushing advanced technology and doing some funding, some R&D. Now the question you might ask here is, why does Iran want to do that? Isn't it better to reconsider some of your policies so that you're not sanctioned in the first place? Okay? Which is a very valid question, right? But I just wanted to indicate ways you can go from here to here, right? Now this brings us to JCPOA. Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now, this was an agreement that over a three-year period was reached between Iran, U.S., U.N., 5 plus 1, which is U.S., France, U.K., Germany, China, and Russia, right? And according to this agreement, Iran would cease its nuclear activities, enrichment, that would be used towards building eventually a nuclear bomb, so that in return they would release some of the constraints on Iran's sanctions, particularly sale of oil, and also release some of the assets that have been frozen. Okay? Now, I want to emphasize that sanctions in this case made some difference, but there was also intense diplomacy. Remember the issue of the carrot and stick that would make sanctions more effective, right? Or resolving your issues more effective. So Iran became more compliant in the nuclear area. this group, this coalition, removed some of the restrictions. Sanctions are subject to snapback in 10 years. In other words, if Iran violates any of those terms, sanctions can come back automatically. And however, there were a certain number of sanctions that remained in place. Human rights, some financial, the ones on ballistic missiles, and some of the financial transactions. And financial transactions here includes use of the dollar for any transaction used with Iran, which again is extremely limited for Iranian commercial activities. Okay, now I want to go over the factors that make the sanctions for the 2012-2015 more effective than the prior sanctions, so that they kind of induced Iran to come and sit at the negotiating table in conjunction with diplomacy. Well, first of all, the trade sanctions have been in place for quite some time, at least between the US and Iran. Oil sanctions, but on top of the oil sanctions, what happened in 2010-2012, Iran had been exporting petrochemical products to Europe. And sanctions started to apply to petrochemicals too. Okay. The other type of sanction was a dual purpose exports. Dual purpose means applies to those products that can be used for civilian as well as military. Now they can again be very limiting because you can categorize anything as something that could be used for military and would become subject to sanctions. Another type of sanction that applied during this was during period was shipping insurance. Again, major constraint. Now, the shipping companies that transport oil don't want to do it without insurance. And European countries, where you have a lot of those insurance companies, especially British, stop providing insurance, which again, kind of helped strangle Iran. You could see a lot of tankers and Iranian ports that could not take off because they were no insurance. Secondary sanctions, as I explained what secondary sanctions were, third parties, which basically makes the scope of sanctions substantially larger. However, all these sanctions would not have been that effective if you did not have the financial transaction sanctions. Reason is, every time you transact something in commercial arena, you're going to have to use finance. And that became a stranglehold for Iran starting with 2012. And what made it even more effective was that it was a united front against Iran because of nuclear war. The size of these indicate their effectiveness, in my view. And without these two, these would not have been that effective. When it says, by the way, the color red indicates that the sanction was very effective. Orange indicates it's somewhat effective. Green means low effect. 2012 to 2015, pretty much I consider everything red. Iran was under the gun. Okay? But I do not want to minimize the importance of diplomacy that the Obama administration was doing behind closed doors with Iran. Was constantly talking about them because they essentially said that if you go along, we'll give you some additional tricks, if you will. Now, what happened last November, November 5th, when President Trump reinstated the sanctions? First of all, trade sanctions, not quite as severe before. Reason I say that is, currently, because of the secondary sanctions and direct sanctions, major corporations cannot interact with Iran, okay? And if you're a foreign corporation, you have the same issue because of secondary sanctions. Right? However, if you're a small trading company, small or medium sized, and you do not work with the US corporations or do not directly transact with the US, that's a way out. So those firms, small and medium sized firms, are right now the focus of commercial activity with Iran because they don't have to worry about being sanctioned by the US. They don't have that big of a relationship. You look at the Chinese, Indian, and a lot of other firms, Korean or Japanese, that are not Sony or not Huawei or some of these major corporations, they don't have the same limiting factors. So I think these factors have somehow become more diluted. The effect of these sanctions are less. Shipping insurance. Now, the major companies in Europe are not providing insurance to Iran. But Iran is working with several Gulf states to get insurance from them in order to ship oil, which again, a way out. International financial transactions are still there, but as you can see, I showed this, the circle is a little bit smaller, and the impact not as severe. But the dollar still is, the use of the dollar as a restricting factor for international trade, because essentially nowadays, with financial transactions back in the play, U.S. says that any country that transacts with Iran and uses dollar, regardless of where they are, will become subject to our sanctions. We're going to pursue them and find them. Okay, so use of the dollar is a major problem, but not necessarily as bad as it was when everybody was supporting the sanctions. And you notice I took this big circle out because right now, a lot of these sanctions have just been allowed by the US, not supported by the European Union or other countries. So what is my conclusion here? That the return of the US sanctions are not nearly as severe as the sanctions of 2012-2015. So it's kind of early to say. It's been only a couple of months since the sanctions were returned, U.S. sanctions. It is very unlikely that Iran will give in. At least that appears to be the conclusion. Why? Because there are ways to get around it. And I'm going to talk about some of the things that Iran is doing to get around sanctions here, even the existing sanctions. Okay, if you look at the 2012, the situation there under Ahmadinejad, and 2018, there are some basic differences. 2012 was populist policies. Ahmadinejad was handing out a lot of dollars in order to keep people happy. And unemployment rate was about 14%, pretty high. Inflation over 30%, and exchange reserves about 100%. In 2018, we have a different government in place. It's a reformist government, more lenient, more conducive to talk with the U.S. Food prices are subsidized, but not everything. Unemployment rate is lower, 11%, not 14%. Inflation rate was actually down to 10% in 2017, the beginning of 2018. And for this, Rouhani's administration deserves some credit. Because since beginning of 2016, when the JCPOA went into effect, last basically 2 years, they were able to bring inflation down, which is significant. But in the middle of last year, as soon as Trump announced that they're going to return sanctions, the value of real dropped, and of course that's one of the ways inflation again started to go up, and right now it's somewhere over 30-35%. Foreign exchange reserves are higher because of the past 40 years people have learned to use some of the domestic products and not be so much reliant on imports. Iran still imports a lot of goods and services. I don't want to belittle that, but the fact of the matter is Iran has also made some inroads in what we call import substitution, creating imports domestically that because of sanctions they could not import. So some of those goods are produced locally, although to a very limited extent. The other thing that Iran has been able to do, and that's also relatively significant, is just over the past year, 17-18, Iran was able to increase non-oil exports to 4.6%. As you know, Iran has been heavily dependent on oil revenue for the past 50 years. That essentially has driven the economy. So the fact that he's making certain strides in non-oil exports, I think is important. It's relatively significant. Also, there are a couple other areas where Rouhani's government has agreed to take steps. And the reason these are significant is because European countries would like to see these reforms before they start transacting more commercial businesses with Iran. One is in the area of banking reform. Now, here I need to explain a little bit about banking. In developed countries, for you to start a business, you have a number of options for your initial investment. One is to issue stock, okay? Now you've heard about the IPOs in the US, right? That is an excellent way to get the capital you need to get a business going. The second way is to issue debt, set a corporate bond, okay? And you take that money and you invest it and you pay the investors over time a certain rate of interest. The third way is to go to a bank. The third way is to go to a bank and borrow money. Unfortunately, the capital markets in Iran have not been very developed. As a matter of fact, the amount of the number of IPOs and private debt is very nominal. So basically, any business that wants to start a business or continue business relies on banks borrowing. Okay? And the activities of banks have been very questionable. There is no transparency. A lot of these banks borrow from central bank, and they're lending to entities that are not very reliable, shady transactions. A substantial part of the loans made to businesses have been to companies that are associated with the Revolutionary Guards. A lot of them are not paying it back. So Europeans said, you want us to do business with you? We want to make sure that we are dealing with an honest bank. So you have to clean up your act. So banking reform is something that Rouhani's government has started at the very, very rudimentary stage, okay? So what they are doing as part of that is essentially close some of the bad banks that they know are reputable in making bad loans or, you know, cooking their books, and helping banks that are sound but need additional capital. And in the process, what they are doing is they are paying off their bad loans. But again, that's at the very preliminary stage. That's part of the bank reform. The second part, which has also been the cause of concern of the Europeans and of course the US as well, is shadow banking. Providing money to suspected individuals for terrorist activities. A lot of money that is channeled to Hezbollah and other parties in the Middle East is done through Iranian banks in a way that's not transparent at all. Now, in 1989, a new agency started in Europe, in France, called the Financial Something Task Force, Financial Actions Task Force. The purpose of this organization is to go after banks that get involved in shadow banking and support terrorist activities in the process. and Iran signed up to that organization. So one of the other conditions of European countries, and of course the US as well, is Iran has to meet those guidelines for money laundering. And this essentially applies to Iran. So that's another thing that Rouhani's government has committed to. Again, not a whole lot of progress, but moving in the same direction, assuming they continue. And the other two things is that's happening in 2018 is one thing Iran has done, again, because of the past experience of sanctions, especially from 2012 to 2015, is Iran is refining the petroleum for internal gas production. They're not dependent on imports anymore, which again, relatively significant. They produce all the gas they need internally. And the last bullet I'm gonna put in quotation marks here, when I say greater unity, there seems to be a little more concurrence between the people and the government in terms of how to deal with the sanctions. Okay? Again, because it's unilateral by the US. So I just wanted to highlight some of the differences which may kind of reinforce why sanctions may not be as effective that, you know, the US sanctions that have been returned relative to 2012, 2015. Now, having said that, yes?
Isn't that true that the 2012 sanctions had a blessing of the UN?
Absolutely, and absolutely. And European Union, right. I didn't dwell on that, but the blue text that I have in few slides before, that's excuse me, that's the I would say that point of inflection of the sanction period against Iran. 2012 became effective exactly because of UN, everybody bought into it, including Russia and China.
That's why it was more effective.
Absolutely, that's correct. Now, even though the past few slides have tried to rationalize what the return of U.S. sanctions in October may not have the same severity or effect on Iran as the 2012 to 2015. However, they still have very important economic impact on Iran, and most of it is negative. So what I've done in this slide, I have put off the green indicates a couple of positive things that happened during sanctions. These are all the negatives. So to start out, you see the negatives are much more than the positives. There are some direct impacts, such as international payments cannot take place, at least not in their regular format. Depreciated currency, real, kind of overnight, you know what has happened to it. And high interest rates. Remember I talked about banking being the only source for people to invest? What is the prime rate in the US? What is the prime rate in Iran? 4 or 5 times as much, 25%. How can you build a business on 25% interest? Okay, so rising interest rates, which again is the impact of sanctions, is a major impediment to further investment, especially when you do not have other sources of funding in Iran, or capital markets are not that developed. Indirect impacts, lower government spending. If the government has lower budget, it cannot invest in the infrastructure, research and development. Okay. Creation of the black market. Now, black market has been with Iran since the imposition of sanctions back in 40 years ago. Every time sanctions are strengthened, black market gets more active. Now, what we mean by black market is a lot of under-table activities, corruption, okay, cheating. So essentially, it really goes beyond the economic realm. It impacts the culture of people. And that's why graft is so common in Iran right now, which is really unfortunate. The exporters who used to export now lose their market share because other exporters from other countries are going to take their share. And of course, one significant impact is lack of technology or R&D exchange, which Iran loses. Now, we know in the past 20, 30 years, technology is the most important factor in increasing productivity. It's not just labor anymore. How the labor is applied, which essentially is a function of the kind of tools they use, technology-driven. And Iran has been losing out on that. These sanctions make it difficult, okay? The intellectual exchange suffers substantially. Now, what do all these going to do? Three things: high rates of inflation, negative growth, unemployment, which is the outcome. So what we end up having, and actually we started seeing in Iran only 2 months into the sanctions, is stagflation. Growth has dropped, inflation goes up, which is extremely damaging. Other impacts are poverty and inequality, and I'll talk about that in a minute. The only positive things are there may be some products that are built internally, so in some areas innovation may pick up, but again, it's going to be very limited. And the import substitution. You may make some of the products at home that previously were imported, so you use domestic products. But again, look at the weight of positives and the weight of negatives. So Iran loses overall, no question about it. All right, let's look at what is the impact. Now, since sanctions have been there for only 2 months, there is no way to look at the actual impact of return of sanctions, because that takes time. One thing we can do, though, since Iran has so much experience with sanctions, particularly the sanctions of 2010-2015, we can take the effects from that period and extrapolate what might happen in the next few months or next couple of years, assuming the sanctions will continue, U.S. sanctions. So essentially, these are takeaways from 2012-2015 that may apply in the next couple of years because of return of sanctions. Now, what happened to Iran between the period 2009 and 2012, in what respect was very significant? What I have here is these percentages refer to the number of people, percentage of people that are poor. What is the definition of poor? It's the 2011 dollars, $5.50 per person per day. Okay, this is something that World Bank uses. So if you're below 5.5, you're considered, you're below poverty line. Now there is also an absolute poverty, which is 2 point something, which pretty much Iran doesn't have it, right? But for the most part, these were the percentages of the poor people. In 2012, that percentage was about 7%. It used to be about 12% in 2009. But because of the Ahmadinejad subsidies, poverty rate dropped. Now, there are other ways to reduce poverty, much better ways, instead of handing people money, like Ahmadinejad did, create jobs, right? But nonetheless, all organizations, international organizations, recognize that level of poverty between 2012 and 2009 and 2012 dropped considerably. But look, what happened during the sanction period, 2013, 2014, 15. By the time we got to 2016, this had notched up by what? Almost 3 points. Now, you look at 3% of the Iranian population, 80 million people. So we added roughly 2.3 million people to the poverty line between 2012 and 2015. This is what you should expect going forward.
middle of poverty is going to increase.
The other thing that I show here, this is actually World Bank chart, is the inequality. Not only poverty increases, so does inequality. Difference between the highest incomes and lowest income. And Iran was 0.32 and it notched up to 0.34 by 2016. It may not seem like a lot, but it's rather significant. So what should we expect because of the return of sanctions? Increased poverty, maybe a little more inequality. Now, we talked about poverty, but we talked in general terms. What does poverty mean when you look at the different provinces in the world? It's certainly not evenly distributed. As you can see, this is the lower bound, this is the higher bound, this is the average, right? 2012-2016 period, if you look at it, the province that had the lowest percentage of poverty was Iran, Alborz, and Qom. The three provinces at the highest rate of poverty were Yazd, Kerman, Sistan, and Belgium. 34%. In other words, 34% of people in those provinces live below poverty line. And part of that was due to the sanctions. Again, I want to emphasize the fact that in economics, when you draw conclusions, we need to qualify, say there are many, many factors. But I don't think it's disputable to think that during this period where the level of poverty increased, a lot of it was not due to the sanctions, multilateral sanctions of against Iran. So sanctions can be extremely harmful, right? As we can see here. Again, I'm extrapolating what happened before about what may happen in the future. But the fact of the matter is, people are going to suffer. Now, people who are mostly affected by poverty, usually households, you have more children, obviously. Households that are headed by younger adults and households that do not have, the head of the household does not work, unemployed. And as we saw, because of sanctions, unemployment rates are going to go up anyway. So we're going to have more of those households. And in terms of provinces, provinces that tend to be more rural tend to be more poor. And of course, will be more adversely impacted by sanctions. So here you have a disparity between the rural areas and metropolitan areas. 18% of rural population with an employed, actually employed head of household are below poverty line in Iran. Significant number. Now, what is it Rouhani's government doing? Again, most of this is talk. It's only been 2 months. We have to see whether they're going to do all this stuff. First of all, they keep talking about the resistance economy. Khamenei, supreme leader, has a charter for resistance economy, kind of a number of things that you do. It's a long list. But essentially what it says, we need to be relying on ourselves with the help of God, that is, a constant referral to the God, to God for helping us, not much to economic policies. The second one is, take advantage of the fact that Donald Trump exempted 8 countries from importing oil from Iran. Now, that's significant, okay? And I think he did that for 2 reasons. First of all, they would not have paid attention to U.S. anyway. China, Korea, Japan, India, they are heavily dependent on Iranian oil. You recognize that's going to wreck their economy, they're never going to do it, so they said, okay, we like you to, we can go ahead and import, but we'd appreciate it if you reduce the level of imports, okay? Accelerate the bank reforms and compliance with money laundering. use austerity measures, essentially meaning tighten your belt, which less spending, which of course is going to affect people. Now, the Europe, as a result of sanctions, the Europeans, by the way, are extremely upset with Trump and U.S. because U.S. essentially is bullying them, right? Same because of the dollar you transact with Iran, you lose your business with us, or we come after you in court, we'll fine you. And they've actually fined a lot of European countries or companies. So what they are saying now, even though the transactions with the U.S. is not a hugely substantial part of their overall trade, over 90% of the transactions that they do in Europe is in dollars. So they are saying, we got to get around this. And they're talking about a special purpose vehicle that will use euros for commercial transactions. Now, that is easier said than done, because all international trade has been basically built around dollars. Now, I'm not sure how soon they can do that. But one of the things that Trump's unilateral sanctions has done is to prompt them to pay more attention to that. Okay? By the way, the same thing is going on in China. China has wanted for some time to use yuan as an international currency. Right now, the use is very limited. But what has happened here may kind of prompt them to accelerate that process. Again, that's not very easy. You know why it's not very easy? Because all countries, after all, if they want to make sure their dollars, their money is safe, they convert it to dollars. Because the U.S. economy is so strong, secure, and U.S. stands behind its words when it comes to commercial. Right? So all the wealthy people, all the major countries, all sovereign debt, sovereign funds, which essentially are funds that save their additional foreign exchange, guess what? Sitting in U.S. banks. For them to move it to yuan or to euro would take a major, major confidence leap on the part of the European Union and China. They need to feel comfortable that their dollars are safe, should say their money is safe, in order to keep them in those currencies. So even though those movements are going along, there are some activities, I don't see that happening very quickly. So dollar is going to be supreme for some time. The other thing they're doing is subsidizing some basic food prices. They are reducing the level of subsidy to people who are relatively well off. There were certain things started under Ahmadinejad when they were giving cash subsidies, and they did not make a whole lot of distinction based on their level of income. Rouhani's administration is doing that because they just can't afford it anymore, right? And they want to reduce the level of subsidy for gasoline, which is huge. About 1.6% of total budget of Rouhani's government goes towards subsidizing gas prices. Quite significant. And use their foreign exchange relatively wisely, support science and technology by giving more money to research. And the other thing that they are focusing on, they've had some success based on the past 2 years, is to increase non-oil exports. Now, a lot of this is talk now. I don't want to imply that they have been very successful at this. You know, they've been at this only a couple of months. They're talking about it, so we have to wait and see whether they actually live these types of commitments and they would have a positive outcome or not. Now, when we talk about the impact of sanctions, a lot of times in the press, they say the winners are the hardliners in U.S., represented by Bolton, the neocons, and the hardliners in Iran. And the losers, European Union, okay? Well, I beg to differ, because the main losers are Iranian people. This is from a demonstration from Shiraz, and I think sometime during last month. And they're protesting high inflation. I mean, for us, just look at the past 10 years, since the financial crisis.
you basically have had no inflation. Those past year or so, about 2%. Just think about living in an economy where you have a 35% inflation rate. Before me is unimaginable. Extreme hardship. I mean, it really can ruin your life. If you're an investor, forget it. Nobody's going to invest, right? How do I know what my money is worth, you know, 6 months from now? And that is why the value of the alt dropped so much. Okay? Tremendous damage.
But mostly ordinary people, mostly people with lower income are facing.
Now, in economics, to decide whether a particular activity is makes sense to do is we use a very, very simple criteria. If the benefits of an action are greater than its cost, it pays off to do it. So essentially, look at all the benefits in dollar terms, all the costs in dollar terms. Benefits exceed costs, and it's a good thing to do. Unfortunately, with sanctions, a lot of times economics doesn't play a role. It's politics, right? Especially if you're dealing with autocratic governments. And so even though the cost is horrendous, they continue with on and on with sanctions. Let me give you an example. Iran was projected to have a 3.6% growth rate during this fiscal year, March of last year to March of this year. It's dropped by, now it's projected to be minus 1.6%. Even started, the drop in growth started before the actual sanctions took effect, when Trump made the announcement. And the anticipation was, according to IMF and World Bank, that Iran would grow in the next fiscal year by 4%. Now the forecast is negative 3.5%. So, in a matter of just a year and a half, Iran growth is going to drop by somewhere around 5%. Total economy is about $440 billion a year. I think 5% of that is like about $23-24 billion, just 1 year that Iran loses. Now, look at the past 4 years, start compounding the losses that Iran has incurred year after year and after year. The overall impact is enormous. And this is just the absolute dollars. Remember, when you don't have the money, you don't invest. If you had the money you had invested, you'd have more growth in the future. So this doesn't even take into account the compound effect of investment. The cost of sanctions to the Iranian economy have been absolutely humongous. So the question is, why don't we have logical parties who sit down, look at this, say, does it make sense that I would sit down and discuss this and try to resolve my differences through difference? Which essentially means withdrawing from some of the actions that they are doing in the Middle East. Okay? Supporting some of the organizations, Syria, Lebanon, and the Houthi rebels in Yemen. That's essentially what US wants. I don't think US wants a regime change. I'm conjecturing now, don't quote me anywhere. I don't want to get into politics here. I'm an economist by trade. I don't think the US is necessarily interested in changing the regime. U.S. wants a neutral Iran. Wants an Iran that's not dangerous, doesn't challenge its position in the Gulf. I think Donald Trump could care less about the Iranian people. He talks about freedom, or it's all about his own entourage in the U.S. Say, okay, what I said, I meant. And of course, Israel is a major factor here, too. So the question is, why aren't some of the elements or the Rouhani government taking these into account, and what can we do so that these sanctions go away, which essentially has to do with foreign policy. That's all I'm going to say about politics. That's it. I'll be glad to answer any questions you have. I think I stopped.